Permit me, I will relate it in German. But in spite of the elegant terms and good accent of the narrator, the German language had no success. At last, nonplussed, I tried to remember my first lessons and to narrate our adventures in Latin, but with no better success. This last attempt being of no avail, the two strangers exchanged some words in their unknown language and retired. The door shut. "It is an infamous shame," cried Ned Land, who broke out for the 20th time. "We speak to those rogues in French, English, German, and Latin, and not one of them has the politeness to answer."
"Calm yourself," I said to the impetuous Ned. "Anger will do no good."
"But do you see, Professor," replied our irascible companion, "that we shall absolutely die of hunger in this iron cage?"
"Bah," said Conseil philosophically, "we can hold out some time yet."
"My friends," I said, "we must not despair. We have been worse off than this. Do me the favor to wait a little before forming an opinion upon the commander and crew of this boat."
"My opinion is formed," replied Ned Land sharply. "They are rascals."
"Good. And from what country?"
"From the land of rogues."
"My brave Ned, that country is not clearly indicated on the map of the world. But I admit that the nationality of the two strangers is hard to determine. Neither English, French, nor German, that is quite certain. However, I am inclined to think that the commander and his companion were born in low latitudes. There is southern blood in them. But I cannot decide by their appearance whether they are Spaniards, Turks, Arabians, or Indians. As to their language, it is quite incomprehensible."
"There is the disadvantage of not knowing all languages," said Conseil, "or the disadvantage of not having one universal language." As he said these words, the door opened. A steward entered. He brought us clothes, coats, and trousers, made of a stuff I did not know. I hastened to dress myself, and my companions followed my example. During that time, the steward, dumb, perhaps deaf, had arranged the table and laid three plates.
"This is something like," said Conseil.
"Bah," said the angry harpooner. "What do you suppose they eat here? Tortoise liver, filleted shark, and beefsteaks from sea dogs?"
"We shall see," said Conseil.
The dishes of bell metal were placed on the table, and we took our places. Undoubtedly, we had to do with civilized people, and, had it not been for the electric light which flooded us, I could have fancied I was in the dining room of the Adelphi Hotel at Liverpool, or at the Grand Hotel in Paris. I must say, however, that there was neither bread nor wine. The water was fresh and clear, but it was water and did not suit Ned Land's taste. Amongst the dishes which were brought to us, I recognized several fish delicately dressed. But of some, although excellent, I could give no opinion. Neither could I tell to what kingdom they belonged, whether animal or vegetable. As to the dinner service, it was elegant and in perfect taste. Each utensil, spoon, fork, knife, plate, had a letter engraved on it, with a motto above it, of which this is an exact facsimile. Mobilis in mobili, N. The letter N was, no doubt, the initial of the name of the enigmatical person who commanded at the bottom of the seas. Ned and Conseil did not reflect much. They devoured the food, and I did likewise. I was, besides, reassured as to our fate. And it seemed evident that our hosts would not let us die of want. However, everything has an end. Everything passes away, even the hunger of people who have not eaten for 15 hours. Our appetites satisfied, we felt overcome with sleep.
"Faith, I shall sleep well," said Conseil.
"So shall I," replied Ned Land.
My two companions stretched themselves on the cabin carpet and were soon sound asleep. For my own part, too many thoughts crowded my brain, too many insoluble questions pressed upon me. Too many fancies kept my eyes half open. Where were we? What strange power carried us on? I felt, or rather fancied I felt, the machine sinking down to the lowest beds of the sea. Dreadful nightmares beset me. I saw in these mysterious asylums a world of unknown animals, amongst which this submarine boat seemed to be of the same kind, living, moving, and formidable as they. Then my brain grew calmer, my imagination wandered into vague unconsciousness, and I soon fell into a deep sleep. Chapter 9. Ned Land's Tempers. How long we slept, I do not know, but our sleep must have lasted long, for it rested us completely from our fatigues. I woke first. My companions had not moved, and were still stretched in their corner. Hardly roused from my somewhat hard couch, I felt my brain freed, my mind clear. I then began an attentive examination of our cell. Nothing was changed inside. The prison was still a prison. The prisoners, prisoners. However, the steward, during our sleep, had cleared the table. I breathed with difficulty. The heavy air seemed to oppress my lungs. Although the cell was large, we had evidently consumed a great part of the oxygen that it contained. Indeed, each man consumes, in 1 hour, the oxygen contained in more than 176 pints of air, and this air, charged, as then, with a nearly equal quantity of carbonic acid, becomes unbreathable. It became necessary to renew the atmosphere of our prison, and, no doubt, the hole in the submarine boat. That gave rise to a question in my mind. How would the commander of this floating dwelling place proceed? Would he obtain air by chemical means, in getting by heat the oxygen contained in chlorate of potash, and in absorbing carbonic acid by caustic potash? Or, a more convenient, economical, and consequently more probable alternative, would he be satisfied to rise and take breath at the surface of the water, like a whale, and so renew for 24 hours the atmospheric provision? In fact, I was already obliged to increase my respirations to eke out of this cell the little oxygen it contained, when suddenly I was refreshed by a current of pure air and perfumed with saline emanations. It was an invigorating sea breeze charged with iodine. I opened my mouth wide, and my lungs saturated themselves with fresh particles. At the same time, I felt the boat rolling. The iron-plated monster had evidently just risen to the surface of the ocean to breathe, after the fashion of whales. I found out from that the mode of ventilating the boat. When I had inhaled this air freely, I sought the conduit pipe, which conveyed to us the beneficial whiff, and I was not long in finding it. Above the door was a ventilator, through which volumes of fresh air renewed the impoverished atmosphere of the cell. I was making my observations when Ned and Conseil awoke almost at the same time, under the influence of this reviving air. They rubbed their eyes, stretched themselves, and were on their feet in an instant. "Did Master sleep well?" asked Conseil, with his usual politeness. "Very well, my brave boy. And you, Mr. Land?"
"Soundly, Professor. But I don't know if I am right or not. There seems to be a sea breeze."
A seaman could not be mistaken, and I told the Canadian all that had passed during his sleep.
"Good," said he. "That accounts for those roarings we heard when the supposed narwhal sighted the Abraham Lincoln."
"Quite so, Master Land. It was taking breath."
"Only, Mr. Aronnax, I have no idea what o'clock it is. Unless it is dinner time."
"Dinner time, my good fellow. Say rather breakfast time, for we certainly have begun another day."
"So," said Conseil, "we have slept 24 hours?
"That is my opinion."
"I will not contradict you," replied Ned Land. "But dinner or breakfast, the steward will be welcome, whichever he brings."
Master Land, we must conform to the rules on board, and I suppose our appetites are in advance of the dinner hour.
That is just like you, friend Conseil, said Ned, impatiently. You are never out of temper, always calm. You would return thanks before grace, and die of hunger rather than complain.
Time was getting on, and we were fearfully hungry. And this time the steward did not appear. It was rather too long to leave us, if they really had good intentions towards us. Ned Land, tormented by the cravings of hunger, got still more angry, and, notwithstanding his promise, I dreaded an explosion when he found himself with one of the crew. For 2 hours more Ned Land's temper increased. He cried, he shouted, but in vain. The walls were deaf. There was no sound to be heard in the boat. All was still as death. It did not move, for I should have felt the trembling motion of the hull under the influence of the screw. Plunged in the depths of the waters, it belonged no longer to earth. This silence was dreadful. I felt terrified. Conseil was calm. Ned Land roared. Just then a noise was heard outside. Steps sounded on the metal flags. The locks were turned, the door opened, and the steward appeared. Before I could rush forward to stop him, the Canadian had thrown him down and held him by the throat. The steward was choking under the grip of his powerful hand. Conseil was already trying to unclasp the harpooner's hand from his half-suffocated victim, and I was going to fly to the rescue, when suddenly I was nailed to the spot by hearing these words in French.
"Be quiet, Master Land. And you, Professor, will you be so good as to listen to me?" Chapter 10 The Man of the Seas. It was the commander of the vessel who thus spoke. At these words Ned Land rose suddenly. The steward, nearly strangled, tottered out on a sign from his master. But such was the power of the commander on board that not a gesture betrayed the resentment which this man must have felt towards the Canadian. Conseil, interested in spite of himself, I stupefied, awaited in silence the result of this scene. The commander, leaning against the corner of a table with his arms folded, scanned us with profound attention. Did he hesitate to speak? Did he regret the words which he had just spoken in French? One might almost think so. After some moments of silence, which not one of us dreamed of breaking, "Gentlemen," said he, in a calm and penetrating voice, "I speak French, English, German, and Latin equally well. I could therefore have answered you at our first interview, but I wished to know you first, then to reflect. The story told by each one, entirely agreeing in the main points, convinced me of your identity. I know now that chance has brought before me Monsieur Pierre Aronnax, Professor of Natural History at the Museum of Paris, entrusted with a scientific mission abroad, Conseil, his servant, and Ned Land of Canadian origin, harpooner on board the frigate Abraham Lincoln of the Navy of the United States of America." I bowed assent. It was not a question that the commander put to me. Therefore there was no answer to be made. This man expressed himself with perfect ease, without any accent. His sentences were well turned, his words clear, and his fluency of speech remarkable. Yet I did not recognize in him a fellow countryman. He continued the conversation in these terms. "You have doubtless thought, sir, that I have delayed long in paying you this second visit. The reason is that, your identity recognized, I wished to weigh maturely what part to act towards you. I have hesitated much. Most annoying circumstances have brought you into the presence of a man who has broken all the ties of humanity. You have come to trouble my existence."
"Unintentionally," said I.
"Unintentionally," replied the stranger, raising his voice a little. "Was it unintentionally that the Abraham Lincoln pursued me all over the seas? Was it unintentionally that you took passage in this frigate?
Was it unintentionally that your cannonballs rebounded off the plating of my vessel? Was it unintentionally that Mr. Ned Land struck me with his harpoon?" I detected a restrained irritation in these words. But to these recriminations I had a very natural answer to make, and I made it. "Sir," said I, "no doubt you are ignorant of the discussions which have taken place concerning you in America and Europe. You do not know that diverse accidents, caused by collisions with your submarine machine, have excited public feeling in the two continents. I omit the theories without number by which it was sought to explain that of which you alone possess the secret. But you must understand that, in pursuing you over the high seas of the Pacific, the Abraham Lincoln believed itself to be chasing some powerful sea monster, of which it was necessary to rid the ocean at any price." A half-smile curled the lips of the commander. Then, in a calmer tone, "Monsieur Aronnax," he replied, "dare you affirm that your frigate would not as soon have pursued and cannonaded a submarine boat as a monster?" This question embarrassed me, for certainly Captain Farragut might not have hesitated. He might have thought it his duty to destroy a contrivance of this kind, as he would a gigantic narwhal. "You understand, then, sir," continued the stranger, "that I have the right to treat you as enemies?" I answered nothing purposely, for what good would it be to discuss such a proposition when force could destroy the best arguments? "I have hesitated some time," continued the commander. "Nothing obliged me to show you hospitality. If I chose to separate myself from you, I should have no interest in seeing you again. I could place you upon the deck of this vessel which has served you as a refuge. I could sink beneath the waters and forget that you had ever existed. Would not that be my right?" "It might be the right of a savage," I answered, "but not that of a civilized man." "Professor," replied the commander quickly, "I am not what you call a civilized man. I have done with society entirely, for reasons which I alone have the right of appreciating. I do not therefore obey its laws, and I desire you never to allude to them before me again." This was said plainly. A flash of anger and disdain kindled in the eyes of the unknown, and I had a glimpse of a terrible past in the life of this man. Not only had he put himself beyond the pale of human laws, but he had made himself independent of them, free in the strictest acceptation of the word, quite beyond their reach. Who then would dare to pursue him at the bottom of the sea, when, on its surface, he defied all attempts made against him? What vessel could resist the shock of his submarine monitor? What cuirass, however thick, could withstand the blows of his spur? No man could demand from him an account of his actions. God, if he believed in one, his conscience, if he had one, were the sole judges to whom he was answerable. These reflections crossed my mind rapidly, whilst the stranger personage was silent, absorbed, and as if wrapped up in himself. I regarded him with fear mingled with interest, as doubtless Oedipus regarded the Sphinx. After rather a long silence, the commander resumed the conversation. "I have hesitated," said he, "but I have thought that my interest might be reconciled with that pity to which every human being has a right. You will remain on board my vessel, since fate has cast you there. You will be free, and in exchange for this liberty I shall only impose one single condition. Your word of honor to submit to it will suffice." "Speak, sir," I answered. "I suppose this condition is one which a man of honor may accept?" "Yes, sir, it is this. It is possible that certain events, unforeseen, may oblige me to consign you to your cabins for some hours or some days, as the case may be. As I desire never to use violence, I expect from you, more than all the others, a passive obedience. In thus acting, I take all the responsibility. I acquit you entirely, for I make it an impossibility for you to see what ought not to be seen. Do you accept this condition?" Then things took place on board which, to say the least, were singular,
and which ought not to be seen by people who were not placed beyond the pale of social laws. Amongst the surprises which the future was preparing for me, this might not be the least.
"We accept," I answered. "Only I will ask your permission, sir, to address one question to you, one only."
"Speak, sir."
"You said that we should be free on board."
"Entirely."
"I ask you, then, what you mean by this liberty?"
"Just the liberty to go, to come, to see, to observe even all that passes here, save under rare circumstances. The liberty, in short, which we enjoy ourselves, my companions and I."
It was evident that we did not understand one another.
"Pardon me, sir," I resumed, "but this liberty is only what every prisoner has of pacing his prison. It cannot suffice us."
"It must suffice you, however."
"What?
We must renounce forever seeing our country, our friends, our relations again?"
"Yes, sir."
"But to renounce that unendurable worldly yoke which men believe to be liberty is not perhaps so painful as you think."
"Well," exclaimed Ned Land, "never will I give my word of honor not to try to escape."
"I did not ask you for your word of honor, Master Land," answered the commander coldly.
"Sir," I replied, beginning to get angry in spite of myself, "you abuse your situation towards us. It is cruelty."
"No, sir, it is clemency. You are my prisoners of war. I keep you when I could by a word plunge you into the depths of the ocean. You attacked me. You came to surprise a secret which no man in the world must penetrate, the secret of my whole existence. And you think that I am going to send you back to that world which must know me no more? Never. In retaining you, it is not you whom I guard. It is myself."
These words indicated a resolution taken on the part of the commander, against which no arguments would prevail.
"So, sir," I rejoined, "you give us simply the choice between life and death?"
"Simply."
"My friends," said I, "to a question thus put, there is nothing to answer. But no word of honor binds us to the master of this vessel."
"None, sir," answered the unknown. Then, in a gentler tone, he continued.
"Now permit me to finish what I have to say to you. I know you, Monsieur Aronnax. You and your companions will not, perhaps, have so much to complain of in the chance which has bound you to my fate. You will find amongst the books which are my favorite study the work which you have published on the depths of the sea. I have often read it. You have carried out your work as far as terrestrial science permitted you. But you do not know all. You have not seen all. Let me tell you, then, Professor, that you will not regret the time passed on board my vessel. You are going to visit the land of marvels."
These words of the commander had a great effect upon me. I cannot deny it. My weak point was touched, and I forgot, for a moment, that the contemplation of these sublime subjects was not worth the loss of liberty. Besides, I trusted to the future to decide this grave question. So I contented myself with saying, "By what name ought I to address you?"
"Sir," replied the commander, "I am nothing to you but Captain Nemo, and you and your companions are nothing to me but the passengers of the Nautilus."
Captain Nemo called. A steward appeared. The captain gave him his orders in that strange language which I did not understand. Then, turning towards the Canadian and Conseil,
"A repast awaits you in your cabin," said he. "Be so good as to follow this man. And now, Monsieur Aronnax, our breakfast is ready. Permit me to lead the way."
"I am at your service, Captain." I followed Captain Nemo, and as soon as I had passed through the door, I found myself in a kind of passage lighted by electricity, similar to the waist of a ship. After we had proceeded a dozen yards, a second door opened before me.
I then entered a dining room, decorated and furnished in severe taste. High oaken sideboards, inlaid with ebony, stood at the two extremities of the room, and upon their shelves glittered china, porcelain, and glass of inestimable value. The plate on the table sparkled in the rays which the luminous ceiling shed around, while the light was tempered and softened by exquisite paintings. In the center of the room was a table richly laid out. Captain Nemo indicated the place I was to occupy. The breakfast consisted of a certain number of dishes, the contents of which were furnished by the sea alone, and I was ignorant of the nature and mode of preparation of some of them. I acknowledged that they were good, but they had a peculiar flavor, which I easily became accustomed to. These different aliments appeared to me to be rich in phosphorus, and I thought they must have a marine origin. Captain Nemo looked at me. I asked him no questions, but he guessed my thoughts, and answered of his own accord the questions which I was burning to address to him. "The greater part of these dishes are unknown to you," he said to me. "However, you may partake of them without fear. They are wholesome and nourishing. For a long time I have renounced the food of the earth, and I am never ill now. My crew, who are healthy, are fed on the same food." "So," said I, "all these eatables are the produce of the sea?" "Yes, Professor. The sea supplies all my wants. Sometimes I cast my nets in tow, and I draw them in ready to break. Sometimes I hunt in the midst of this element, which appears to be inaccessible to man, and quarry the game which dwells in my submarine forests. My flocks, like those of Neptune's old shepherds, graze fearlessly in the immense prairies of the ocean. I have a vast property there, which I cultivate myself, and which is always sown by the hand of the Creator of all things." "I can understand perfectly, sir, that your nets furnish excellent fish for your table. I can understand also that you hunt aquatic game in your submarine forests. But I cannot understand at all how a particle of meat, no matter how small, can figure in your bill of fare."
"This, which you believe to be meat, Professor, is nothing else than fillet of turtle. Here are also some dolphin's livers, which you take to be ragout of pork. My cook is a clever fellow who excels in dressing these various products of the ocean. Taste all these dishes. Here is a preserve of sea cucumber, which a Malay would declare to be unrivaled in the world. Here is a cream, of which the milk has been furnished by the cetacea, and the sugar by the great fucus of the North Sea. And lastly, permit me to offer you some preserve of anemones, which is equal to that of the most delicious fruits." I tasted, more from curiosity than as a connoisseur, whilst Captain Nemo enchanted me with his extraordinary stories.
"You like the sea, Captain?"
"Yes, I love it. The sea is everything. It covers 7/10 of the terrestrial globe. Its breath is pure and healthy. It is an immense desert, where man is never lonely, for he feels life stirring on all sides. The sea is only the embodiment of a supernatural and wonderful existence. It is nothing but love and emotion. It is the living infinite, as one of your poets has said. In fact, Professor, nature manifests herself in it by her three kingdoms, mineral, vegetable, and animal. The sea is the vast reservoir of nature. The globe began with sea, so to speak, and who knows if it will not end with it. In it is supreme tranquility. The sea does not belong to despots. Upon its surface, men can still exercise unjust laws, fight, tear one another to pieces, and be carried away with terrestrial horrors. But at 30 feet below its level, their reign ceases, their influence is quenched, and their power disappears. Ah, sir, live. Live in the bosom of the waters. There only is independence. There I recognize no masters. There I am free."
Captain Nemo suddenly became silent in the midst of this enthusiasm,
by which he was quite carried away. For a few moments he paced up and down, much agitated. Then he became more calm, regained his accustomed coldness of expression, and, turning towards me, "Now, Professor," said he, "if you wish to go over the Nautilus, I am at your service." Captain Nemo rose. I followed him. A double door, contrived at the back of the dining room, opened, and I entered a room equal in dimensions to that which I had just quitted. It was a library. High pieces of furniture, of black-violet ebony inlaid with brass, supported upon their wide shelves a great number of books uniformly bound. They followed the shape of the room, terminating at the lower part in huge divans covered with brown leather, which were curved to afford the greatest comfort. Light, movable desks, made to slide in and out at will, allowed one to rest one's book while reading. In the center stood an immense table, covered with pamphlets, amongst which were some newspapers already of old date. The electric light flooded everything. It was shed from four unpolished globes half sunk in the volutes of the ceiling. I looked with real admiration at this room, so ingeniously fitted up, and I could scarcely believe my eyes.
"Captain Nemo," said I to my host, who had just thrown himself on one of the divans, "this is a library which would do honor to more than one of the continental palaces, and I am absolutely astounded when I consider that it can follow you to the bottom of the seas."
"Where could one find greater solitude or silence, Professor?" replied Captain Nemo. "Did your study in the museum afford you such perfect quiet?"
"No, sir."
"And I must confess that it is a very poor one after yours. You must have 6,000 or 7,000 volumes here."
12,000, Monsieur Aronnax.
"These are the only ties which bind me to the earth. But I had done with the world on the day when my Nautilus plunged for the first time beneath the waters. That day I bought my last volumes, my last pamphlets, my last papers. And from that time I wish to think that men no longer think or write. These books, Professor, are at your service besides, and you can make use of them freely."
I thanked Captain Nemo, and went up to the shelves of the library. Works on science, morals, and literature abounded in every language. But I did not see one single work on political economy. That subject appeared to be strictly proscribed. Strange to say, all these books were irregularly arranged, in whatever language they were written. And this medley proved that the captain of the Nautilus must have read indiscriminately the books which he took up by chance.
"Sir," said I to the captain, "I thank you for having placed this library at my disposal. It contains treasures of science, and I shall profit by them."
"This room is not only a library," said Captain Nemo. "It is also a smoking room."
"A smoking room?" I cried. "Then one may smoke on board?"
"Certainly."
"Then, sir, I am forced to believe that you have kept up a communication with Havana."
"Not any," accepted the captain. "Except this cigar, Monsieur Aronnax. And though it does not come from Havana, you will be pleased with it if you are a connoisseur."
I took the cigar which was offered me. Its shape recalled the London ones, but it seemed to be made of leaves of gold. I lighted it at a little brazier, which was supported upon an elegant bronze stem, and drew the first whiffs with the delight of a lover of smoking who has not smoked for 2 days.
"It is excellent, but it is not tobacco."
"No," answered the captain. "This tobacco comes neither from Havana nor from the East. It is a kind of seaweed, rich in nicotine, with which the sea provides me, but somewhat sparingly."
At that moment Captain Nemo opened a door which stood opposite to that by which I had entered the library, and I passed into an immense drawing-room splendidly lighted. It was a vast, four-sided room, 30 feet long, 18 wide, and 15 high. A luminous ceiling, decorated with light arabesques,
shed a soft, clear light over all the marvels accumulated in this museum. For it was, in fact, a museum, in which an intelligent and prodigal hand had gathered all the treasures of nature and art, with the artistic confusion which distinguishes a painter's studio. 30 first-rate pictures, uniformly framed, separated by bright drapery, ornamented the walls, which were hung with tapestry of severe design. I saw works of great value, the greater part of which I had admired in the special collections of Europe, and in the exhibitions of paintings. Some admirable statues in marble and bronze, after the finest antique models, stood upon pedestals in the corners of this magnificent museum. Amazement, as the captain of the Nautilus had predicted, had already begun to take possession of me. "Professor," said this strange man, "you must excuse the unceremonious way in which I receive you, and the disorder of this room."
"Sir," I answered,
"without seeking to know who you are, I recognize in you an artist." "An amateur, nothing more, sir. Formerly, I loved to collect these beautiful works created by the hand of man. I sought them greedily, and ferreted them out indefatigably, and I have been able to bring together some objects of great value. These are my last souvenirs of that world which is dead to me. In my eyes, your modern artists are already old. They have 2,000 or 3,000 years of existence. I confound them in my own mind. Masters have no age." Under elegant glass cases, fixed by copper rivets, were classed and labeled the most precious productions of the sea which had ever been presented to the eye of a naturalist. My delight as a professor may be conceived. Apart, in separate compartments, were spread out chaplets of pearls of the greatest beauty, which reflected the electric light in little sparks of fire. Pink pearls, torn from the Pinamarina of the Red Sea, green pearls, yellow, blue, and black pearls, the curious productions of the diverse mollusks of every ocean, and certain mussels of the watercourses of the north. Lastly, several specimens of inestimable value. Some of these pearls were larger than a pigeon's egg, and were worth millions. Therefore, to estimate the value of this collection was simply impossible. Captain Nemo must have expended millions in the acquirement of these various specimens, and I was thinking what source he could have drawn from to have been able thus to gratify his fancy for collecting, when I was interrupted by these words. "You are examining my shells, Professor. Unquestionably they must be interesting to a naturalist, but for me they have a far greater charm, for I have collected them all with my own hand, and there is not a sea on the face of the globe which has escaped my researches." "I can understand, Captain, the delight of wandering about in the midst of such riches. You are one of those who have collected their treasures themselves. No museum in Europe possesses such a collection of the produce of the ocean. But if I exhaust all my admiration upon it, I shall have none left for the vessel which carries it. I do not wish to pry into your secrets, but I must confess that this Nautilus, with the motive power which is confined in it, the contrivances which enable it to be worked, the powerful agent which propels it, all excite my curiosity to the highest pitch. I see suspended on the walls of this room instruments of whose use I am ignorant." "You will find these same instruments in my own room, Professor, where I shall have much pleasure in explaining their use to you. But first come and inspect the cabin which is set apart for your own use. You must see how you will be accommodated on board the Nautilus." I followed Captain Nemo, who, by one of the doors opening from each panel of the drawing room, regained the waist. He conducted me towards the bow, and there I found not a cabin, but an elegant room, with a bed, dressing table, and several other pieces of excellent furniture. I could only thank my host. "Your room adjoins mine," said he, opening a door, "and mine opens into the drawing room that we have just quitted." I entered the captain's room. It had a severe, almost a monkish aspect. A small iron bedstead, a table, some articles for the toilet,
the whole lighted by a skylight. No comforts, the strictest necessaries only. Captain Nemo pointed to a seat.
"Be so good as to sit down," he said.
I seated myself, and he began thus. Chapter 11. All by Electricity.
"Sir," said Captain Nemo, showing me the instruments hanging on the walls of his room, "here are the contrivances required for the navigation of the Nautilus. Here, as in the drawing room, I have them always under my eyes, and they indicate my position and exact direction in the middle of the ocean. Some are known to you, such as the thermometer, which gives the internal temperature of the Nautilus, the barometer, which indicates the weight of the air and foretells the changes of the weather, the hygrometer, which marks the dryness of the atmosphere, the storm glass, the contents of which, by decomposing, announce the approach of tempests, the compass, which guides my course, the sextant, which shows the latitude by the altitude of the sun, chronometers, by which I calculate the longitude, and glasses for day and night, which I use to examine the points of the horizon, when the Nautilus rises to the surface of the waves."
"These are the usual nautical instruments," I replied, "and I know the use of them. But these others, no doubt, answer to the particular requirements of the Nautilus. This dial with movable needle is a manometer, is it not?"
"It is actually a manometer, but by communication with the water, whose external pressure it indicates, it gives our depth at the same time."
"And these other instruments, the use of which I cannot guess?"
"Here, Professor, I ought to give you some explanations. Will you be kind enough to listen to me?"
He was silent for a few moments. Then he said,
"There is a powerful agent, obedient, rapid, easy, which conforms to every use and reigns supreme on board my vessel. Everything is done by means of it. It lights, warms it, and is the soul of my mechanical apparatus. This agent is electricity."
"Electricity?" I cried in surprise.
"Yes, sir."
"Nevertheless, Captain, you possess an extreme rapidity of movement, which does not agree well with the power of electricity. Until now, its dynamic force has remained under restraint, and has only been able to produce a small amount of power."
"Professor," said Captain Nemo, "my electricity is not everybody's. You know what seawater is composed of. In 1,000 grams are found 96.5% of water, and about 2 2/3% of chloride of sodium. Then, in a smaller quantity, chlorides of magnesium and of potassium, bromide of magnesium, sulfate of magnesia, sulfate and carbonate of lime. You see, then, that chloride of sodium forms a large part of it. So it is this sodium that I extract from the seawater, and of which I compose my ingredients. I owe all to the ocean. It produces electricity, and electricity gives heat, light, motion, and, in a word, life to the Nautilus."
"But not the air you breathe?"
"Oh, I could manufacture the air necessary for my consumption, but it is useless, because I go up to the surface of the water when I please. However, if electricity does not furnish me with air to breathe, it works at least the powerful pumps that are stored in spacious reservoirs, and which enable me to prolong at need, and as long as I will, my stay in the depths of the sea. It gives a uniform and unintermittent light, which the sun does not. Now look at this clock. It is electrical, and goes with a regularity that defies the best chronometers. I have divided it into 24 hours like the Italian clocks, because for me there is neither night nor day, sun nor moon, but only that factitious light that I take with me to the bottom of the sea. Look, just now it is 10 o'clock in the morning."
"Exactly."
Another application of electricity. This dial hanging in front of us indicates the speed of the Nautilus. An electric thread puts it in communication with the screw, and the needle indicates the real speed. Look, now we are spinning along with a uniform speed of 15 miles an hour.
It is marvelous.
And I see, Captain, you were right to make use of this agent that takes the place of wind, water, and steam.
We have not finished, Monsieur Aronnax, said Captain Nemo, rising.
If you will allow me, we will examine the stern of the Nautilus.
Really, I knew already the anterior part of this submarine boat, of which this is the exact division, starting from the ship's head. The dining room, 5 yards long, separated from the library by a watertight partition. The library, 5 yards long. The large drawing room, 10 yards long, separated from the captain's room by a second watertight partition. The said room, 5 yards in length. Mine, 2.5.